Talk about today. Today, as everyone I'm sure is aware, is Thanksgiving, which, though itself is an American holiday, not a Jewish holiday, certainly has a lot of Jewish roots. And I want to talk about the concept of gratitude. And there's a lot to talk about it, but I want to do it from perhaps a slightly unusual angle, which is by talking about the Korban Todah. There's a specific offering that was given in the temple. There are more source sheets around if people are still missing. There's a specific offering that was given in the temple that was specifically made for those who are thankful, for gratitude. And what I want to talk about is the nature of gratitude in general by analyzing some of the rather nitty-gritty details of that offering. And I want to begin actually with perhaps something that sounds very, very, you know, in the nitty-gritty details. But I want to suggest as we go through the class that this question is actually going to get us to the core of what gratitude is really about. And so the first thing I want to talk about is this kind of nitty-gritty detail. Take a look at the Mishnah, source number one. This is the Mishnah that if you read that part in the daily service after Brachot, but before Mizmor Shir, before Pesukei Dezimra, the part that has a list of different learnings and korbanot, the part that most people skip, although here at Mount Torah, people are very intense about because I think Rabbi Berman's really intense about it. So we do actually always say it. But if you read through those Mishnayot, the Mishnayot list the fifth parak of Zvachim, and so there's a list of various korbanot and some of their basic rules. So I want to focus for a second on the second two that are listed here. The second paragraph says as follows: Hatodah ve'el nazir kachim kalim shechitan b'chol makom ba'azara ve'nechalim b'chol ir l'chol adam b'chol machal l'yom v'layla ad chatzot. The Todah and the El Nazir were a type of kachim kalim. Kachim kalim means holy things which are lighter. That's what it literally means. It means that there's less strict requirements, as opposed to what we're going to learn later for kachim, which are offerings that have a higher level of sanctity. Now, what's the difference? The difference between higher levels of sanctity versus lower levels of sanctity is that higher levels of sanctity, actually, I want to read from the beginning of the Mishnah. The first Mishnah says, "Eiz mekan shel tzvachim, kachi kachim shchidatam b'tzafon." If it's something which is something of the higher sanctity, so then it's offered in a particular place. It's slaughtered in a particular place. V'nechalim lifnim min haklayim lezichrei kehuna b'chol machal liyom v'layla ad chatzot. And it has to be eaten specifically within the temple grounds. It cannot be eaten anywhere. It has to be eaten in the temple. And it can only be eaten for the first day. Like that particular day when it's offered, that's it. And the subsequent night, it cannot be eaten the next day. Any food left over the next day is going to be what's called notar. It has to be burnt. It cannot be eaten. The second case Mishnah quotes is what's called the Todah and El Nazir. El Nazir we're going to skip for today, but Todah, that's the Thanksgiving offering, the offering we're going to be talking about today. And that offering is what's called the Kachim Kalim. It's part of the category of those sacrifices which have a lower level of sanctity because the rules are less strict. Namely, as opposed to Kachim, which are allowed to be offered anywhere in the city, can only be in the temple, Kachim Kalim can be eaten anywhere in the city of Jerusalem. Not only that, but Kachim Kalim can generally be eaten by more people. Kachim are pretty limited. Most of them can be only eaten by Kohanim, by priests. It's like different rules depending on exactly the category. But Kachim Kalim is really meant to be eaten by everyone. All Jews are equally open to eating from Kachim Kalim. Now, here's where it makes things interesting, because the Mishnah then lists out the general category of Kachim Kalim, which is called Shlamim. Shlamim are shared offerings that are shared between part of it's given in the Mizbeach, part of it's given on the altar, part of it's eaten by the priest, and part of it's eaten by the owners of the animal. And the general rule is that Shlamim are really the prototypical type of Kachim Kalim. They're really the prototypical type of this lower sanctity animal of offering that can be eaten anywhere in Jerusalem, that has, can be eaten by anyone. And what makes it unique is that it can also be eaten for more time. The general rule is that it can be eaten l'shnei yamim v'layla echad. It can be eaten for 2 days and one night. Sorry, 2 nights and one day. So you have a longer time to be able to eat it, right? You offer it on the day, that particular day, the subsequent night, and the subsequent day, all of those times can still be eaten for for Kachikalim for these Shlamim. So what's interesting, though, is that the Todah, this is the rather nitty-gritty detail that I want to focus on as kind of the jumping point for the questions that I want to talk about, is that when it comes to the Todah, despite the fact that the Todah, that the Korban Todah, is considered to be an offering of Shlamim, in all other ways, it has all the same rules as Shlamim. Shlamim are shared offerings, offerings that are shared equally between part of it is given to God on the altar, part of it is given to the priest, and part of it is given to the owners. So that's the same thing happens with the Korban Todah. Like a Korban Shlamim, Korban Todah has the same rules in terms of where it can be eaten. It can be eaten anywhere in Jerusalem. It has very similar rules in terms of who can participate, and that everyone can really eat from the Shlamim, from the Korban Todah. But there is one seeming exception, that all of a sudden by the Korban Todah, you have a more limited amount of time to eat the Korban Todah. As opposed to Shlamim, which usually you have 2 days and one night, or one day, the subsequent night, and the subsequent day, when it comes to the Korban Todah, you only have 1 day and one night. So you have less time to eat it. So the question I want to ask, and this is a rather specific question, but why is it that the Korban Todah, the Thanksgiving offering, despite being in all other respects like every other Shlamim, why is it that when it comes to the question time of how long you have to eat it, are you limited to only 1 day and one night? So this is a very classic question that's asked by many people about the Korban Todah. There are different answers given. I'll just mention as an aside, one of the perhaps most classic answers is quoted by the Abar Banel. You can see it in source 2 if you like. I'm not going to read it inside, but the Abar Banel and others suggest that part of the motivation for limiting the time span for how long you can eat the Korban Todah is because the Korban Todah, by its very nature, was this Korban that was a very large offering. It had a lot of breads, a lot of meat. It was a very expansive, luxurious meal. You know, even more, it'll be like our Thanksgiving meals later today. It was this really luxurious meal, and because the time was limited, it compelled you as an owner, as the person offering this sacrifice, to invite your friends. You have so much food, what are you going to do otherwise? It's going to have to be thrown out because you have a very limited amount of time to eat it. So the argument is that because the intentional limitation of the time was in order to motivate you to invite your friends along as well. Why do we want specifically your friends to be invited for this particular offering? Because there's something very significant in the fact that we share our thanks, our gratitude, not only amongst ourselves, but within our community, that everyone can kind of participate in our gratitude as kind of a communal form of gratitude. This is a beautiful idea, very nice about gratitude. If we are giving a drasha, maybe for Shav Tzav, maybe that's what we'll talk about. But I want to go in a very different direction. But it is a really nice idea on its own. But I want to suggest something a little bit different about why the Korban Tamid has a slightly different rule than other Shlamim. And to do that, I want to suggest Korban Todah. Korban Todah. If I said Tamid, I've misspoken. Korban Todah. We're talking about the Thanksgiving offering. So to do that, what I want to suggest is that in general, from the parshiot of Korbanot, when it comes to sacrifices, there are generally two different motivations or broad speaking categories of Korbanot. And this can be seen already a little bit in the verses themselves. So the very first verse, or second verse really, of Book of Leviticus, describes the first Korban. It says as follows in source number 3. If an individual offers a sacrifice to God. Now, why is an individual offering the sacrifice? You want to tell me why are you offering the sacrifice in verse 2 of Leviticus? So the Torah doesn't actually explain why are you doing it. It seems like, and this is the way that most people read it, it seems like this is your heart compels you. You feel the divine call that you feel like you should give an offering to God in some way, and you decide to give this offering. You're not necessarily compelled to do so. It is what you would call a voluntary offering. In contrast, a little bit later on, a few chapters later in the book of Leviticus, in chapter 5, we're introduced to what's called the Korban Chatat, the sin offering. And the sin offering, as its name suggests, is not brought voluntarily, but rather it's brought in response to having sinned. So, for instance, we're told, this is source number 4, V'nefesh ki techeta v'haya ki yesham lachat me'ele v'hitvada asher chata leha v'hivyet ashamo l'ashem al chatato asher chata. If a person, an individual, man or woman, has sinned, then they bring this offering. Now, the rules of the offerings are a little bit different, but the goal, my main point here, is to primarily point out this rather significant distinction between those offerings which are voluntary and those offerings which are obligatory. Now, I assume many of us have heard this distinction before, but I think this type of distinction is really going to be important to when we talk about gratitude. Because as we'll see, gratitude, I think, interestingly enough, spans the difference between these two categories. So to get into gratitude a little bit more, I want to kind of begin talking about the Shlomim specifically. And it's worth noting that the Shlomim itself actually is divided into two different categories. So if you take a look at source number 5, when the Torah describes what the Shlomim is, the Torah says as follows, V'zot Torah Zevach HaShlomim Asher Yakriv LaHashem. This is the order of the offering of the Shlomim. Im Atoda Yakrivenu, if you bring a Shlomim because you are thankful, because of a sacrifice of thanks, so then what you should do is V'yakriv HaZevach Todah Chalot Matzot B'lev HaShemen. There's a whole list of rules of what you will bring along with that offering. However, verse 16, V'im Neder O Nedava Zevach Korbano, if instead your offering of a Shlomim is not given because of thanksgiving, but rather it's in response to a Neder or a Nedava, some type of vow that you made to God that you promised to give an offering, so then there are slightly different rules. Now, what's interesting then is that we have, in effect, two different types of Shlomim here. And this is, in fact, what we saw a little bit earlier from the Mishnah itself. Because this these Pesukim delineate pretty clearly that they have a different amount of time that each are allowed to be eaten. So when it comes to the first category of a Zevach Todah, we're told explicitly that you're allowed to eat it only for the first day. Verse 15, Yusar Zevach Todat Shlamav B'yom Korbano Ye'achel Lo Yaniyach Mimenu Ad Boker. You're not allowed to eat it after the second, on the second day. As opposed to in the second category, where there you're allowed to eat it the first day and the second day, and only on the third day is it going to be problematic. Verse 17, V'anotar Basar Zevach B'yom HaShlishi B'ishi Saref. The third day is only going to be the day that is problematic. So those are just the verses that I think help clarify and help just point out to you this distinction. And so the question really is, yes, it's true that a Korban Todah is part of the Shlomim, and yet the rule for Korban Todah is a little bit different than usual. And so the real question I want to ask is why? Why is it that the Korban Todah has a different amount of time than all the other forms of Shlomim, despite the fact that it's kind of listed within the larger scheme, all the other rules are similar? And I actually made a chart. Charts in a second. So, in order to answer this question, what I want to suggest is I want to kind of take a step backwards and talk about the more broad distinction between kachay kalim and kachay kachim, between these two different types of sacrifices. Now, I'll make the introduction, and this is something that hopefully I'll have a chance to share a lot with you, which I find kachim to be fascinating. And more often than not, it's not taught very well. And let me explain what I mean by that. I think the details, some people are really fascinated by the details. You know, you love memorizing the charts. And that's great that if you're one of these people. To be honest, it's not my favorite pastime, but if that's yours, that's great. What I think is so interesting and is often missed is that the details of these various offerings are not just details. Like, yes, it's true, this is a ritual, and rituals, by definition, have various rules. But the rules are often significant in that they tell us about the very nature of the offering. Let me give you a good metaphor for what I refer to. If an offering is a form of a gift, right, you can give a gift for very different reasons. Right? If I can give a gift, let's say, to my wife, Mindy, for very different reasons. I can give a gift because, you know, today is just a day I want to show her that I love her. So I give her, I send her flowers. I can also give a gift because, hey, I did something bad last night, and I want to, you know, apologize for it, so I send her a gift, you know, whatever that gift is, in order to, you know, appease her in some ways. Or maybe I'm sending a gift because I want to show my thanks, because you did something really nice, because you set up this party for me. You know, there are very different reasons for why you would give a gift, and you can give the same gift, but for many of us, we actually have this language, and it's a little bit subtle, but there might be even a notice, you might notice that certain types of gifts represent different types of meaning, right? So if you give a rose, that's very different from giving other types of flowers, which is different from giving chocolates, which is different from giving your coworker, some souvenir from your recent trip abroad, right? These are all gifts, but they come in different mediums, and they mean different things. And I think the same thing is true about korbanot. Korbanot have different details. And yes, we can focus on the details, and it's interesting in its own right, and it's Torah, and it's great. But we miss half the point if we only focus on the details without thinking for ourselves, what are the details that really represent about what type of offering is this? What is this type of offering trying to suggest about our relationship to God through this particular, you know, sacrifice, this particular medium? So that's kind of the broad question that I think all sacrifices need to be dealt with. And so when I want to talk about this distinction between these two broad categories, what's called Kachi Kachim and Kachi Kalim, you can take a look at this chart, and this sort of summarizes the mission that we saw earlier, that lists kind of the differences between the two types of offerings. So when it comes to Kachi Kachim, these what are called, you know, literally means the, you know, elevated types of offerings. So you can see that it's more limited. It's limited to only one day and one night. It only can be a place of offering, where it's a place it's actually sacrificed, is north of the altar. It can only be eaten within the temple, and it's primarily only eaten by priests, no one else. As opposed to Kachi Kalim, which are much more broad, they are much more open to everyone, they can be eaten by everyone, they can be eaten all over Jerusalem, they can be slaughtered anywhere in the temple, and they can be eaten for a lot longer. Now, what's the difference? Why is there such a significant difference between Kachi Kachim and Kachi Kalim? So most of that difference has to do with the essential nature of what Kachi Kalim and Kachi Kachim are doing. Kachi Kachim, when you think of a sacrifice, who owns the sacrifice? And by maybe make that more precise, whose food is the food the offering supposed to be? Right? I, as an owner, I give over a sacrifice to God, but once I do that, that effectively is a type of gift. And now whose food is it? It's God's food. It's offered on God's altar. And the Kohanim, yes, for the most part, can participate, but when they're participating, they're not eating their food. They're eating God's food, which is why it's so limited, because God, in effect, grants us food from his table, you know, from God's table, but it still is God's food. So for some Kachi Kachim, they're going to be limited only the altar eats it, like what's called the Korban Ola. It's completely burnt on the altar. Some of that, the Kohanim and the priests are able to participate in, but in all of them, it's very clear, it's God's food. This is meant to be something that's solely for God, and yes, it may be shared, but the same way that a king or a host might invite guests to their table, and you still would consider it to be, you know, their food, it's not the guest's food. So the same thing's true here, they're just guests at the table. And that's why it's going to be limited to within the temple. Everything's limited in terms of how long you have to eat it for. It's going to be very much delineated based on who the ownership is. It's owned by God. That's very distinct from the case of Kachi Kalim. Because by Kachi Kalim, by what's called this lower level of offerings, this type of what's called Shlamim, there the rules dictate that the food is meant to be shared. Because in contrast to Kachi Kachim, which are really meant to be thought of as God's food, Kachi Kalim are meant to be thought of as a shared project between God and people. The way to think, I think about it, perhaps the best metaphor for it, is it's kind of like a potluck lunch. And in the sense that God owns part of the offering, yes, of course you are, as the owner, the one who brought the sacrifice. But now that you brought it to the temple, part of it's owned by God, so it's like a potluck, God's bringing his portion, and you, as the owner, are also bringing your portion. And so because it has that kind of merging, of God and the owner or the people. So it has slightly different rules. It has more broadly open rules. It can be eaten by anyone. It can be eaten anywhere in Jerusalem. Right? It's much more open to reflect the fact that this is an offering meant to be shared. Now, to be clear, these two different types of offerings, whether it's owned by God or whether it's shared, are not just random details into what type of offering you want to give, but they really represent very different types of ways that you approach the divine. At times, we approach the divine in a way that we want to share things, right? We feel like we want to have this potluck lunch, right? I had such a great time. I have something to be thankful for. I have something that, you know, I'm happy about. So I share my joy with everyone. It's not because I'm not necessarily coming with a sense of humility here. I'm coming to God and I'm sharing this offering. I could have had this meat, you know, at home, but I decided to bring it to the temple because I want to share in my joy with God. There's something about bringing God within my joy, within my, you know, all of my celebrations. That's very different than kachikachim, where when I'm bringing an offering to God, I'm doing so not out of a sense of joy and of openness, but I'm bringing the offering out of a sense of humility. More often than not, kachikachim are brought out of a sense of sin. I have sinned, so I'm saying sorry. But even if the motivation is not precisely a sin, regardless, the way you're doing the offering is clearly motivated on the fact that I'm just a lowly human being, I have many of my moral failures, and I'm trying to offer something up to the divine, up to the Ein Sof, to, you know, the omnipresent, omnipowerful divinity, and I'm trying to really suggest this kind of this hierarchy between me and the divine, between me and the divine. So those are two very different ways that we approach God, and in our own ways we might approach, you know, our own families. Sometimes, you know, if you give a gift to your spouse, you might be saying sorry in a more humble sense. Sometimes you might be saying thank you in a more open sense. But I think these are very different ways that we give these gifts. Now, this brings us to perhaps the key detail that I want to talk about that really, I think, differentiates and really points out what Korban Todah is, which is, what about the time? Why is it that by Korban, forget Korban Todah for a second, why is it by generally, by kachikachim, by offerings that are more sanctified, you have only the day of the offering and the subsequent night to eat it? Why, by opposed to kachikalan, you can eat it for the next 2 days? You have 2 days to eat it. Why is there more time to eat for kachikalan? Anyone have a suggestion?
I suggested that people who are giving a carbon toda, the number of people who do that are more plentiful than people bringing carbon asha, whatever it is. And it may be an issue of being concerned that the meat will get rancid and say it's cool.
So the problem is that the amount of food, though, doesn't really vary between the Korban Todah, the Thanksgiving offering, that has a lot more food. But in general, between a Korban Chatat, a sin offering, versus a Korban Shlamim, the amount of food between the general Shlamim versus the Korban Chatat or Asham is exactly the same. It's the same type, same size of animal. There's not really going to be a difference, even though the fact that the Shlamim can be eaten for 2 days, the chatat will only need it for one. Not only that, but this is a more minor detail, but I would say that the Korban Chatat has a more limited population that can even participate. So you actually have less eaters to be able to eat for less amount of time the same amount of meat that you're able to eat for the Korban Shlamim. So, yes, people do make that suggestion about the time being a question of the meat becoming rancid, or perhaps we're concerned about, you know, other types of spoilage or other types, those type of issues. But it doesn't really explain why is it that by the Korban Chatat and Asham and the Ode Kachikachim, we have a different amount of time, even though it's the same amount of meat as the Kachikala and the Shlamim. Want to have more suggestions for why the difference? So I want to share this really, really fascinating suggestion that Rav Samson Rafael Hirsch makes. And his argument is based on the way that time is conceived of in the Torah. When we think of time, I mean, more precise, when we think of the day, when does the day begin in halacha? At night. So the typical answer is it's at night. Indeed, that's the way we keep Shabbos, right? Shabbos begins at night. Our holidays begin at night. Hanukkah begins at night. Right? That's the way it typically works. But is that always true? In the temple, what? Not for Korbanot. In the temple, when did the day begin? The day began not at night, they actually began during the day. Which is why the very first task of the day is, what's the very first thing the Kohanim did after they opened the gates? No, before the Tamid. Before that.
Clean out the altar.
Yeah, they would clean out the altar. They would take out the garbage from yesterday. The very first thing you do is you clean up yesterday's mess. That's the very first thing you would do. And that would really open up the new day. And then the day would continue. They'd offer a bunch of sacrifices. And what would they do at night? What would they do in the temple at night? Anyone know what type of offerings they would do or what type of activities? Usually not, but if they were burning something, they'd be burning the leftover meat, what's called the aktarat evarim, the innards and the parts of the animals that aren't eaten by any humans. They would burn those on the altar. So in effect, it's kind of like the leftovers on the grill. What?
Incinerator.
Yeah, I mean, it's not incinerating it. It's an offering. But yeah, it's effectively like the leftovers being incinerated for the day. Because the day in the temple really begins in the morning and ends at night. And this is actually something that's broadly set throughout Tanakh. I know it's very much set in our mind that the day begins by day and the halachic day starts at night. But it's actually like a very big debate. I'll mention as an aside, perhaps like what's the source that we think of when we think of that halachic day begins at night? Right? Because God, it was night, it was day, and that was one day, suggesting that the first day begins at night. The Rashbam has a fascinating commentary. I didn't quote it here, but maybe a different time I will quote it inside. But the Rashbam makes this fascinating comment. He says that's not what the verse means. Vayi erev vayi boker does not mean it was night, it was day, that's the definition of the day. Instead, what it means is as follows. Vayi erev, the night passed. Vayi boker, the day or daybreak arrived. And at that moment, Yom Echad, the first day had been completed. Right? God began creation during the day. Light was created, which is what we call daytime. Then darkness came, which is our night. And at that point, after night came, the beginning of daybreak of day two came, and that's when we delineated the end of day one. So in the Rashbam's reading, actually this verse by Erev Vayivoker actually teaches us that day should actually begin, the concept of a day begins in the morning, not in the evening. An interesting side point with regard to Rashbam, but here's what I want to bring up that Rav Hirsch brings up for the Korban Shlamim. In effect, we have two very different conceptions of time, and there's a lot of philosophy that's, you know, we'll talk about maybe a different moment about, but there's something very interesting that the temple time begins in the day, ends at night, and for human beings, the way that halacha conceives of our time, time begins, the day begins at night and ends in the morning, or ends in the afternoon. Yeah.
This one's related to Mr. Yalevi on the Arab. I don't have to repeat it. Maybe. Because it's the day. Because it feels like Beit Midrash.
It is like Samachar to make that suggestion, but the typical explanation for Yalevi Yavo is for different reasons. Because they wouldn't be Mekadosh the month at night. So it's slightly different reasons, but yes, it is an interesting suggestion you're making. When it comes though to the when it comes to the offerings, right? A kachi kachim. Why is it that you can only offer it? You can only eat it that very same day? Because the whole point being is that it's God's offering. So God had this offering given to him during the day, right? I offered it today, this morning, so it can be eaten today. And it can be eaten tonight, because this is part of the same day. This is part of me sharing from God's table. I can't eat it the next day, because, well, God's not eating it either the next day. So why should I be able to eat it the next day? This is already too late. As opposed to by Shlomim have this very interesting combination. Because on the one hand, yes, I'm offering the offering during the day, and I can therefore eat it that day and the subsequent night. But I also can eat it that night and the subsequent day afterwards. Right? So I have a day, night, a day. Effectively, is a combination of the two types of time. You have on the one hand the time of God, which is day and a night, and then you have at the same time the night and then day of human beings. And so what Hirsch suggests is that there's this fascinating combination for Korban Shlomim where the time span you have allowed to eat it actually reflects these two different, very different conceptions of time, which are reflective of the different nature of the offering itself. The offering itself is a potluck, a combination of humans and God, and therefore the amount of time allowed to eat it is a combination as well. Anyone have any questions about that? It's a rather side point. If you didn't fully follow it, that's okay. I think it's fascinating. But that's not what I... If you didn't follow it, I think it's okay for what I want to think there by Korban Todah. So when it comes to Korban Todah, all the other rules about Korban Todah parallel Korban Shlomim. In all other ways, it really has the standard rules of Korban Shlomim. Except for how long you have to eat it. Why not? So I suggested by Korban beginning that it might have to do with this rule that we want people to be able to share it and might want to intentionally limit the amount of time. I want to suggest something different. Perhaps it's not because we're intentionally trying to limit the time, but because we're trying to suggest that the Korban Todah has in it an aspect of being similar to a Kachi Kachim. That it's not fully a Kachi Kalim, it actually spans the border between these two categories. Why would that be true? Why would the Korban Todah be between these two categories? Because if we think about the distinction of what motivated these two categories, we had on the one hand Kachi Kachim, which were primarily based on offerings which are obligatory. Right? I sinned, I'm being humble in front of God, I am saying sorry. The opposite of which was what we call the Korban Shlomim, which is this voluntary offering to God. Now, what's interesting about Korban Todah is this offering of gratitude is I wouldn't naturally think, oh, gratitude is something you do voluntary. But the truth is gratitude really always voluntary? I have, my son is, 14, is about 16 months old. He's barely starting to speak. And Mindy and I are both trying to teach him to start saying the word, thank you. Now, it's probably a long-term project for most kids, but I think it's very normal. Most people do try teaching their kids to have gratitude. And it's not just because that's, it's not just we're trying to inculcate necessarily... That sentiment suggests that it's more than... gratitude is more than just something that you do that's, like, nice. It's something that maybe you have a responsibility for. Someone does something nice to you, you have a responsibility to say thank you, to be gracious. Now, exactly how that responsibility can be, spoken about is in itself an interesting question. Mm-hmm. There's this whole span of philosophy that discusses exactly where gratitude stands between, on the one hand, what some philosophers like talking about virtues, it's just like a nice thing to do, versus other philosophers that talk about gratitude as like a debt, right? So it's the same way I owe someone money, so I owe a debt of gratitude, which suggests it's like it's owed to you. So gratitude itself kind of spans the middle. It's on the one hand, it's not really a debt. No one really wants to, get a gift from someone and say that you owe them to pay them back the gratitude, right? It's kind of like sometimes some people think of like invitations on Shabbos meal, like, oh, I invite you for Shabbos meal, now you owe me Shabbos meal back. Now that's not really gratitude, that's a little bit more than gratitude, that's like a trade of some sort. Like, gratitude though does suggest some form of responsibility, but not the same extent as fully obligatory. Right, it's somewhere kind of spans the difference, and if we're giving, both lecturing in philosophy, we could talk about exactly the differences and how exactly you express it. But the point being is that I think the Torah itself reflects this very same difference by differentiating the Korban Todah from the other forms of Shlomim. Yes, it's true. The Korban Shlomim, Korban Todah, they all are these type of voluntary offerings. But in point of fact, the Korban Shlomim, the general Shlomim, is the Torah begins as the Im Neder O Nidavah, as a vow. When I give a vow to God, I am effectively offering something of my own free volition. I say to God, I want to give you an offering, this is my offering. Korban Todah, though, why do I bring a Thanksgiving offering? I give the offering in response to something that's happened to me. Something specific has happened, and I now feel a debt of gratitude, and I say thank you. Yes, it's true that I, you know, don't have to bring the offering, but the fact is that I almost am compelled to follow the rules of normal behavior of graciousness and respond by saying thank you to the good thing that's happened to me. So, for instance, take a look at source, the last source to look at, but source number 11. The Mishnah in Brachot Brachot talks about, and this is the source for Birkat HaGomel, which is modeled off of the Korban Todah, but the Mishnah says as follows, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, there are four types of situations in which you're obligated to bring a Korban Todah or Birkat HaGomel. What are the four categories, four situations? Someone who has crossed the sea, someone who has crossed the desert, someone who has been ill and has recovered, and someone who has been kept as a hostage and has been let out of prison. All four of these cases are people who can say Birkat HaGomel, can bring a Korban Todah. But take a look at the way that the language of the Gemara actually expresses this. It doesn't say these four people have the opportunity to bring a Korban Todah or to say a Gomel. It says, Arba'a Tzrichin Lehodot. There are four categories of people that are obligated. Being thankful in Halacha is not something that it's an option. It's not just like, oh, God allows you to be thankful here. You actually are somewhat mandated to be thankful. And Rashi, if you want to take a look, Rashi actually even expands and says that these four cases are just examples. The truth of the matter is, Birkat HaGomel and Korban Todah can be given any time you have something to be particularly thankful about. If you've been saved in some miraculous way, you should say thank you. I know I have like a friend who I remember very clearly was once in Israel and was going through a checkpoint, and I think at that very moment as going through a checkpoint, a Molotov cocktail had been thrown at their car. It had just missed their car, and the very next day, this guy came to shul, and he said a Birkat HaGomel because his life had been spared. He felt, you know, he felt like he was saved. And in fact, the question arises, I mean, not as the war goes on, but God willing, when the war ends, everyone, not just the people who are on the front line, but even the people who are just, you know, in Tel Aviv, who rockets have fallen nearby, there's a real question being asked, should you say a Birkat HaGomel? And it's a whole question about should say it, not say it. Different people have different suggestions. Maybe it should be a communal HaGomel. Different, you know, it's a little bit the technicalities in terms of how a halachic system sees it. But
it's not one of the four.
Yes, but even though it's not one of the four things, the point being that Rashi and the Rambam and others quote is that the four things are just examples. They're just things that list cases of when, in theory, you would, you know, would ordinarily have your life feeling threatened, and now you're being thankful for. But in truth, if any time that you have a very significant salvation, you would say Birkat HaGomel. It's a little bit of a debate.
You get divorced.
Sorry? Yeah, childbirth would be an example that it's a little bit of a debate. It's not fully clear-cut, so there's a little bit of a debate about it in terms of, like, practical halacha. But for the most part, what we typically paskin is that, yeah, anytime you're saved or something miraculous happens to you, then you would indeed make a bracha Birkat HaGomel, which is why common practice, I don't think it was always true, but definitely now it's become very popular, that women who've had the privilege of giving birth, indeed, often make a bracha Birkat HaGomel.
That's under the category.
So that's one way of expressing what it means, but others suggest not based on cholas because of the child itself.
You do.
But the question becomes, I mean, I don't want to get into the details of this, but like, if God forbid a woman has passed through the danger, but unfortunately the child didn't survive, it was a miscarriage of some sort, you don't say a gomel, even though the mother is out of her danger, she's no longer in danger, but at the same time, you know, you don't want to be happy for it because your child died tragically. So there are some like subtleties between these positions, but I agree with you, it's not so clear cut. There's more to talk about. But what I want to point out at the end of the day is we talked about the specific details of Birkat HaGomel and Korban Todah, but I want to suggest, ultimately, that the reason that the Korbanot are offered in this way, that the time span is limited to one day, it's not just because we want to include everyone else in this offering. Yes, that's true. It's also a nice positive. But I think it's intentionally made in this way because we're trying to point out, through the very details of the Korban, that gratitude is not just a Korban Nedava. It's not just a type of vow offering. It's not just an offering I'm giving fully out of my own free will. It's not just, it's something that has a certain level of obligation. And that in general, when we think about a day like today, like Thanksgiving, yes, it's true that there's something virtuous in saying thank you. There's something that we should feel good about the fact that we're saying thank you. That's something that we're doing out of our own volition. But at the same time, there's almost an expectation to do so. And though it's true that in some ways it might feel like it cheapens it, I actually think in many ways the fact that you fulfill an obligation actually gives it a little bit more meaning. Because yes, it's true that if I do something voluntarily, you know, it's nice, I'm volunteering to do something, I didn't have to do it, I'm doing it now. There's something really significant about doing something that you didn't think you had, that you had to do. I'll give you just a personal example. When I was a kid, I occasionally would make money here from various like odd jobs here and there, from babysitting or whatever it is. I would get paid for it, and it was nice to get paid for it. But I'll be honest, now that I get paid and I need the money because I need to support my family, that type of payment, that type of salary, has a very different significance to me than it did when I was younger. It's just, it has like an added significance because I need the money, because it's something that's almost obligatory. And I think in general in life, we often think of, you know, voluntary things that are always better. The truth is, there's often more meaning attached to things that are obligatory, and I think there's something really special, the fact that gratitude is one of these categories that kind of spans the difference. And on the one hand, it certainly is voluntary, but on the other hand, it also has this aspect of compulsion that I think really gives it this meaning. And so, in the honor of that thought, of this cheer of Thanksgiving, not only should this hopefully be, you know, a beginning of a very thankful Thanksgiving, I don't know what everyone does for their meals. I hope you have some type of festive meal. But I would suggest, and not everyone does this, but I think it's so obvious that we should do it, spend a moment in your meal thinking about what you're actually thankful for, and maybe even go around the table. Everyone should be listening about what they're thankful for. I think it's a very nice gesture to kind of encapsulate what the day is really about. But not only should this be true about Thanksgiving, but the way the calendar happened to work out and events in Israel is that hopefully one of the four categories listed in Mishnah is indeed Chovei Shvirim, the release of captives, and hopefully this shir and our own gratitude on today will be in a merit of accomplishing the hostage release goal, the trade that's being negotiated and finalized in Israel. Hopefully it goes through and our days are really become a much more thankful and special days.
Amen. Thank you, Rabbi. I got to run. Happy Thanksgiving.